Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King, a Dorchester boy, will try to shake his Bruins blues and tell us if, after a key Senate vote, immigration reform is closer to becoming a reality, and is Edward Snowden closer to returning home? Then we'll ask you this. It's in the mid-90s, so what is appropriate to wear to work? Shorts? T-shirts? No ties? And what happens when the interns become skin turns, Marjorie?
Then WGBH regular Dan Kennedy tells us about who has stifled free speech right here in New England. Plus, Ben Mezrich, whose most famous book became the Oscar-winning movie basis for The Social Network. He'll tell us about his newest book and how he became a best-selling author himself. That's coming up on Boston Public Radio, WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
What do you say? It's a scorcher? What's our theory?
It's a scorcher.
It's a scorcher.
Yeah.
It's the Fall Reeve girl over there.
That's right.
Joining us online, as he does every Tuesday at noon, is Dorchester's own John King. He is CNN's chief national correspondent. Good afternoon, John.
It's a scorch out here, too, in Washington.
That's right. Wasn't it a scorcher in Dorchester when you were a kid, John King?
I know what you mean, Marjorie. I know what a scorcher is.
Okay.
Although I love the part in your newscast there. Avoid strenuous activity, but get out and vote.
Yeah, that's right. There's not that many people getting out to vote so far in Massachusetts. We hope that picks up before the end of the day. But, John, you know, we don't know yet how the Supreme Court is going to decide the Defense of Marriage Act or Proposition 8, but there has been a 5-4 decision. We just learned, handed down today. The Supreme Court just struck down key parts of the Voting Rights Act. This is a huge, big deal.
It is a big deal. You had yesterday a ruling on affirmative action where they sort of punted. They sent a case back to Texas saying, we're not going to throw out affirmative action, but you guys just didn't apply it right, so go back and try again. Here's the other case we were waiting for, essentially the social legal architecture coming out of the civil rights movement. You know, you have a number of states that are still subject to either the entire states or parts of states that have been required for years now to submit to the Justice Department their plan for holding an election. And that was done because of past discrimination, mostly against African Americans, sometimes against Latinos, sometimes against people of different ethnic backgrounds who didn't speak English or who didn't have education. So what the court said today was this has been on the books for 40, 50 years, and you can't keep applying the same test. So they threw it out, essentially saying states have to rewrite this to adapt to the times. Problem is, you know, you can't get a bill saying the sunshine is good or sunrise is good through the United States Congress right now, and you've got a number of these states that will interpret this quite differently.
So just to be clear, if Congress doesn't update the list of states which should be subject to this preclearance, as it's called, where states have to submit any change in election laws to the Justice Department, if Congress doesn't act, essentially this part of the Voting Rights Act is dead, yes?
Significantly gutted and near dead. Yes, you've already seen, you know, the Attorney General in South Carolina saying, you know, thank you that this has been outdated and that the federal government is putting too much of a burden on states. Remember, the Constitution says that states run elections unless there's a federal problem, and racial discrimination is a federal problem. And so it's up to the states to do these things. And I'm not saying this to make a political point. I'm saying it to make a fact. If you look at the states now affected by the Voting Rights Act, most of them are governed by Republicans. Most of them happen to be in the South, and most of them their first reaction has been good. This is long overdue. The question is, you're going to see, and you're already seeing it from civil rights group, African American organizations. The President of the United States just issued a statement just moments ago, saying he's deeply disappointed by that decision, and he's calling on Congress to pass legislation to fix it. Tough one to get through the Congress in this environment. But there's a question. There's a huge policy question here now of whether these states can move forward without the oversight of the federal government. And then there's the political impact of, you know, how will it be debated in Congress? How will it be debated in these states? And might it be an issue, a motivational issue, if you will, in the 2014 midterm elections?
Yeah, let me do a ridiculous hypothetical just so I completely understand. What is really bothering people like the president, and I've read Congressman Lewis and Senator Leahy from Vermont, if they believe that the Congress actually could fairly establish, could update the rule, the facts about who, which states are discriminating or not, they wouldn't be so troubled about the decision, I assume, because essentially what Justice Roberts, Chief Justice, seems to be saying, the data upon which this preclearance requirement is based is decades old, so let's update it. If they actually believed that Congress had it in them to update the data fairly and swiftly, they wouldn't be so upset about the decision. Is that a fair statement?
It's a very fair statement. The decision from the conservative majority, you can feel the scorn they have for Congress, essentially saying, you guys chickened out. They just reauthorized the Voting Rights Act a few years ago, and it passed the Senate by 98 to nothing. So, look, you know, no one wanted to stop and do the hard work they probably should have done to say, okay, which states have improved? Maybe some states have gone in the wrong direction. Maybe there's a county in that state that's been covered by preclearance for 40 years, but they're doing a good job now. Let's take them off the list, but maybe, you know, up the road a bit, there's some place that's gone for the worse, and we need to put them on the list. But that would have been a very difficult environment, right? Then you have to have these congressional hearings. You're essentially accusing people of racism and discrimination and other violations of the Voting Rights Act. And so instead, the Congress just re-upped the whole thing. And didn't go through. And what the court is saying is, no, you can't do that. That'll, some of these places, and some of them have. Of course, some of them have gotten better. But not all of them, maybe. And that's the Congress's job. But can you see this? I mean, this Congress, again, watch what we're seeing in the immigration debate. Watch what we're seeing in other debates. And this is one of the toughest issues. You know, when you bring race into anything, it becomes incredibly tough. So we'll see. We'll see if this president in the second term, with all the problems he's having right now, can convince Congress, and that includes a Republican-run House right now, to go state by state, county by county, and raise these issues.
We're talking with John King from CNN. The Supreme Court just this morning handed down a decision striking down a key part of the Voting Rights Act. John King, are we to expect now that there's going to be, presuming Congress is, as usual, unable to do anything self and doesn't do anything, we're going to see all these initiatives now, IDs, licenses to vote, all the kind of thing that people are fearing prevent people from easy access to the polls?
It's a great question. I mean, obviously, you're going to have not only the organizations that believe that the court did the wrong thing today, or the organizations that believe that even if the court's argument is valid, that a lot of these rules, you know, the standard's been in place for 40-plus years, it's time to have a new standard adapted to the times. If they don't get their way, you know they're going to put significant oversight, significant scrutiny on these state and local officials as the elections go forward, and you'll have complaints. But we went through some of this in the last campaign, remember, where some states had new voter ID laws, and the Supreme Court has ruled on this issue that you can have a state voter ID law. That's okay as long as it's not a significant burden to voting. There has to be a reasonable, you know, reasonable alternative for somebody who doesn't have an identification, whether they're elderly or whether they're new to the community. But you can bet, sure, you can bet that any time you have a major ruling like this, what you get from it is, you know, then you get the next round. Now the states will have to carry on an election without this, assuming nothing's going to happen by the time the next election comes, and I'm guessing that's a safe assumption. They're carrying it out in a new environment, and there will be people, God bless them, who try to do the right thing, who try to prove that we don't discriminate anymore, and the court was right, and there will be other people who will probably try some shenanigans.
You know, John King, as you're speaking, last thing on this, I think I'm right. Isn't this the case during oral argument where John Roberts made a comment about the discriminatory practices in places like Massachusetts are worse than in some of the states on the list? And then Bill Galvin, the Secretary of State, actually hit back at him.
Yeah.
This was this case. You know, you mentioned about immigration. I assume last night the United States Senate forgot who they were and actually in a bipartisan fashion, what is it, 67-27, adopted this amendment, dramatic amendment on border security that means what? That it is possible that the final bill in the Senate could get as many as 70 bipartisan votes?
I think it is possible the final bill could get 70 bipartisan votes, and this is going to sound odd. This is going to sound a little ridiculous, but that may not be enough to send the proper signal to the House. It will send a signal to the House. Anything getting 67 or maybe we get to 70 by final passage in the Senate sends a pretty powerful message to the House. However, that would still be a minority of the Senate Republicans. And to get something with a path to citizenship through the House, the Speaker, we'll see if this holds up in the end, the Speaker has said, any bill that passes the House should be able to get a majority of the Republicans, not just a majority of the House, but a majority of the Republicans. And to do that in the current environment and include a path to citizenship acceptable to the President of the United States, at least by his current definition, that's a Harry Houdini. I don't see that right now.
You know, getting back to the border security amendment that was apparently pretty critical to some moderate to conservative Republicans, Is it rhetoric or real when some of the proponents have said, with the addition of these 20,000 border security people, we will essentially have shoulder-to-shoulder human beings on the borders? How much of an exaggeration is that? 20,000 additional people seems like a huge number to me.
Well, it's an exaggeration in the sense that you're not going to have shoulder-to-shoulder, but they're going to have 20,000 new people. The question then, the next fight will be how many of them are sitting at desks in Washington. Mm-hmm. Or desks in other places, and how many are actually down there on the border. But you're also extending the fence, and you're bringing in some other technology as well.
Drone aircraft.
Using drone aircraft.
Yeah.
At a time when, and we'll see if this changes because our economy is starting to pick up, at a time when if you actually go to the border and talk to the people there, either the mayors in the border towns, I'm not saying there's not drug violence, I'm not saying there aren't horrific things happening on the border, but the number of people crossing is actually down.
Well, it's actually net negative. Isn't there a net negative because of the economy, at least until a few minutes ago, meaning Mexico into the United States, John King?
Right. Yes, and in part that is because our economy has been in the slump. Again, it's starting to come back, and we'll see if that changes things. And the Mexican economy, and I'm not going to say it's booming, but the Mexican economy is thriving, has been stronger and has been rebounding before the American economy. So even people, say, from Guatemala and El Salvador who are looking for work outside of their countries, some of them may be finding it in Mexico instead of continuing north and crossing the border illegally.
So let's move on to Edward Snowden. He's the guy, of course, who leaked the information.
He's trying to go the other way across the border.
Exactly. Well, that's what's so weird about this case. Snowden is the NSA guy, leaked the information about people, the NSA collecting our phone call information, other online data. He's apparently still in Moscow. The Russians won't send him back to us, and China and Hong Kong wouldn't either. So you kind of look at this and you say, gee, the Obama administration can't convince the Chinese or the Russians, and they can't even convince some countries in Latin America that might take Snowden in. Is this a big embarrassment for the United States in terms of our power around the world and for Obama specifically?
Yes, and let me make clear that there's no indication it would be any different if George W. Bush were still in the White House. Remember, he started off with a very good relationship with Vladimir Putin, and it soured at the end.
Yeah.
So there's no indication the Chinese, that they would be nicer to George W. Bush. And maybe they would be, but we can't say that on this day. However, remember, when President Obama came to office, he said one of his guiding missions on the world stage would be to repair, in his view, all the damage George W. Bush did to America's standing in the world. He said he would reset the Russian relationship. Just a week or so ago, 10 days ago, he was out in California on the West Coast having a much longer, more private, try-to-get-to-know-you meeting with the new president of China. And so then what happens this week? I call this the Pontius Pilate moment, both by China and by the Russians now, so trying to wash their hands of Edward Snowden, saying,
yeah.
What? Who? Edward Snowden? Huh?
Yeah.
We have this. What could we do? These are two of the most authoritarian governments in the world who we have all watched have a heavy hand when it comes to these things within their own borders. And so the United States says, we need this guy. We want this guy. We're taking his passport away, which usually means protocol is you put that person on the first plane back to their native country, their last country of citizenship. And both China and Russia say, no, sorry. And Putin just gave a news conference. He's in Finland today. And he said, it's not our problem. We'd like him to leave, pick his final destination as soon as possible. Essentially telling President Obama, go away.
But I don't want to mean to ever correct the great John King, but the latest out of Putin a couple of minutes ago is he won't return Snowden, but he will return Bob Craft's ring. Are you aware of that? Hey, John, do you read Andy Borowitz? He's our favorite satirist. Do you read Andy Borowitz, the Borowitz Report?
I love Andy.
Yeah, Borowitz makes a great point. I'm paraphrasing. I can't be nearly as funny as he is. He said essentially there's nothing to worry about. If you're one of the 350 million Americans who we are spying on, don't worry about it because we didn't even know what Edward Snowden was doing, so we can't monitor one. Hey, John, before we let you go, how many times have you relived 17 seconds from last night since about 11 o'clock?
You want to know the worst of this? I was a hostage for 5 hours in LaGuardia Airport last night. I couldn't get home from New York. I was up doing something at our office up there. And when I got on the plane, finally, the Bruins had just scored to go ahead 2-1. Mm-hmm. I was watching the game at LaGuardia. So I got on the plane reasonably confident. And I landed to the New York Times alert on my BlackBerry, the CNN alert on my BlackBerry, and my best friend from childhood, Chris O'Neill, who still lives there, I got his alert, too. I cannot repeat one word he said in his alert. It was a It was a great text message from my good buddy who was actually at the game and is very disappointed. But
17
wow.
seconds that will live wow. in infamy. It was
yeah.
brutal.
I'm sorry, John.
You know what? It was a great series, and this is the wonder of it all. But so L.A. stealing our basketball coach. Chicago stole our Stanley Cup. The Red Sox better keep it together. That's all I can say.
Hey, John King, it's a pleasure. We'll talk to you next Tuesday.
John King from CNN. He joins us every Tuesday at noontime. Thank you again, John, for being with us. Up next, it's really hot outside. You may have noticed that. And when it is hot, delivery people who work at UPS and mail carriers get to wear shorts to work. Can you? What kind of summer clothes are okay and not okay at work? Flip-flops? Halter tops? What can you get away with at the office? Stay tuned for that conversation. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And it's hot, but you knew that. What you might not be quite so sure about is what to wear to work when it is hot. Or short sleeve shirts, like one worn by Scott Brown we saw on the paper last night at a Gomez rally. Okay, how about sundresses? Do you really want to see your boss in a pair of shorts? And what to do when the favorite intern morphs into a summer skin turn. So how far can you push summer clothes in the workplace? That's the question we're going to try to answer with you guys in the next few minutes. 877-301-8970. I know you have an incredibly strong feeling about shorts on men.
I do.
Just get it out of your system and let's move on.
Well, I think generally speaking, you know, after a certain age, mm-hmm. probably 21, mm-hmm. the shorts generally don't work on men. You know what I'm saying? But if you are going to go that route, Jim, they can't be the short shorts.
You mean like Larry Bird used to wear at the beginning of his career with the Celtics?
No thighs should be involved.
Give the do's or don'ts for men. We'll get to women in a second. Our number is 877-301-8970. What do you wear to work when it's 95 degrees? Is there a dress code at your office? Do you stretch it? What are the boundaries for men? By the way, I am wildly against what mm-hmm. Scott Brown looked like last night at the Gomez thing. You don't wear short-sleeve shirts. You do what I'm doing. You roll up the sleeves of long-sleeve shirts,
and
correct?
And when it comes to style, Jim, no one absolutely would doubt that you are the
what
expert
else?
On this kind of thing. But I think you're right. Short-sleeve shirts, I don't know. I always think of bad things like serial killers and stuff in short-sleeve shirts. You know what I mean?
How about sandals on men in the workplace? I'm not talking at a big-time law firm or a bank. How about sandals? Totally inappropriate, correct?
If they're
totally inappropriate.
No, I don't say they're necessary. You don't want to wear socks with the sandals. You never want to do that. And if you're going to wear sandals, the toes should be pretty much covered because toes on men particularly are not that attractive. Toes on women, of course, are a different story because everybody has painted toenails now. So if, you know, you see a lot of those sexy shoes in the summertime, and those are absolutely fine. But I think with men, it's easier for men because basically if you're going to wear shorts, I mean, reading up on this morning, they have to be tailored shorts. They have to be long shorts that are down to the knee.
Of course,
no
I agree
involved.
With that.
But I think the tougher thing is women, because the skin turns, as you mentioned, those are the interns, you know, that come to work for the summertime and have no idea how to dress because mm-hmm. young women don't anymore.
You've had some of those problems at a particular workplace
right,
that shall remain unmentioned.
Where people show up with, you know, the cleavage that you only see in Playboy magazine mm-hmm. or worse these days, or halter tops, braless kind of outfits, or see-through kind of outfits. What do you think about see-through kind of outfits at the office?
Well, I don't think anybody's going to be saying
well, maybe
a see-through
people,
outfit is okay,
you never
okay,
know,
Marjorie.
Jim. Some people might like it. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. And also, this is a conundrum. If you are a person in management and you have an inappropriately dressed 23-year-old woman who's coming from college to work there for the summer, it becomes very problematic.
Not if you're
her.
A woman. Well, you have to find a woman. If you're a male manager, you got to find a woman to have the conversation,
that's right.
Right?
Preferably a very pregnant woman to have the conversation. So there's no sort of, you know, the man can have the conversation because it's too humiliating. I mean, we did have this problem at one workplace that shall remain nameless, where a woman, beautiful young woman, but she came in really short skirts, mm-hmm. the mini skirts, the flip-flops, and the cleavage sort of deal every day. And she was so distracting that the men, certainly, and even some of the women couldn't get their work done, but then they didn't know what to do about it. Because they didn't want to be, you know, accused of sexual
harassment.
Can I
be clear here? You do not want me to say that it was the Boston Herald, correct? No, I just want to be clear. You don't want me to say that, so I won't. 877-301-8970. Let me tell you, I am a master also at little perks that employers should use mm-hmm. to make people feel better. The first hot day, there should be a memo out from the boss that says, here's the deal. We want to make it as flexible and as relaxing as possible. You can't do X, whatever X is, as long as it's reasonable. Is there any reason a man has to wear a tie in this environment? Any
ties,
reason at all? It's ridiculous.
Unless you're working at Ropes and Gray or something like that. Law firms tend to be very formal, but I don't.
But
think
why?
You have to wear a tie.
But I understand
because
that
because you're meeting with clients, and if you're involved in a multi-million-dollar lawsuit, I don't think you want a guy who's there like with his shirt open and shorts on. I mean, you want someone that looks like they're dressed for the job. How about flip flops? Should women be able to wear flip flops at work?
Flip flops, no. Regular sandals
really?
On women are okay. A variety of sandals, and as you say, that there's the sandal and the sandal. We'll have that discussion another day. Totally inappropriate for me. There's a great piece on it. Is it Slate.com? I think it's Slate.com. Yeah, there is. And one of the headlines of do's and don'ts, and then we'll get to your calls at 877-301-8970. Save your skin. Mini dresses, mini skirts, short shorts, halter tops, and half shirts should not be worn at a professional meeting. And here's the parenthetical I love. When in doubt, if the article of clothing has a hyphen in it, it is probably off limits. 877-301-8970. And let me just say one last thing.
What?
When you pass somebody who isn't allowed to relax the rules. You see, Chelsea was mentioning this morning, UPS, Postal Service, they let the mail deliverers wear shorts. It's great. How about a doorman? At a major hotel
point.
Where they're buttoned up,
oh,
they
yeah.
have the hats on. It's like it's practically Guantanamo like.
Wear the top hats.
No,
the
whatever.
Summer?
I don't know if they wear top hats.
Buttons?
They have to wear something. In any case, let's go to the calls. Let's start with Carla. You're in a car. What's appropriate summer dress at the office, Carla?
Well, I run a nonprofit in Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Many years ago, and we had lots of interns, just what you're talking about. And say I'm long past intern age. And I just said, okay, that's it, 3 Bs, no boobs, no butts, no belly. I just don't want to see them. And so my operations person issues an email at the beginning of every summer. This is our policy, remember. And we added no flip-flops a few years ago. We're in a real old house in the south side of the city, and the flip-flops are as much a safety issue as they are.
So, Carla,
beyond
the 3 Bs, and you filled it in the blanks, I won't fill them in again, essentially anything beyond that goes because you want your workforce to be relaxed and comfortable, right?
Well, I mean, yeah. And, I mean, what I'd really like to do is control some of the dress of the folks who come in to the office. I have no control over that. But, you know, most offices are air-conditioned these days. Everybody's car is air-conditioned. So, I mean, sort of, you know, I think it becomes a little bit of an exhibitionist kind of thing if people are coming into work, you know, half-dressed. So.
Yeah.
Don't have an exhibitionism bias, Carla. Keep an open mind. Thank you so much for the rules at your Providence nonprofit.
You know what I always think has changed, too? Like, what's 20 that? Or 30 years ago when women were... I mean, not just entering the workplace, but more and more women were entering the workplace. Yeah. There were all these rules about how you were supposed to dress, and you had to think a lot about
it. It was really buttoned up.
Seriously, yeah. But now, I think you can dress as a woman really very sexily at the office and be taken seriously and get ahead. The idea was if you dressed sexily in the 1970s, you could not be taken seriously. I think that's changed.
Speaking of the 70s, and let's speak of the 60s, you see the finale to Mad Men the other night?
I did. I saw most of it.
One of the best hours of television.
It's pretty
ever.
Impressive. I was flossing during one of the important sections.
877-301-8970. We're talking about what's appropriate summer attire in the office. We just heard from an employer, a woman who runs a nonprofit in Providence. How about some employees? Let's go to Janine. I hope it is in Holliston. Janine, you're next on, or Jean Ann, I think it is, on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
This is my first time calling, and I just wanted to mention that I actually work for a woman who runs a company who helps people with these issues.
Really?
Yeah, her name's Mary Lou Andre. She, our company is Organization by Design. She actually writes a blog about what's appropriate and what's not appropriate for the office. And I know she just recently had a blog post about what men should and should not do.
Well, give us, since we can't look at it as quickly as you know it, give us the key do's and don'ts from your boss, Gina.
I think her number one was the socks and sandals.
You mean you can't wear sandals?
With socks.
With socks, okay.
It's a big no-no. I think it's the number one no-no on our list. And I always giggle when I see it.
Yeah.
You know, somebody I'm like, ooh.
That's sort of like... you shouldn't wear socks with sandals anywhere.
Ever. I agree.
When you go down the Cape in the summertime, you see some guy. It's like the socks with sandals match the fanny pack. That would be my thing, especially when they're black socks and sandals. You know what I'm saying?
How about the women, Jane Ann? What's the deal there? What's your boss say about women do's and don'ts?
You know, as far as like the low cut, you know, it's really not appropriate to have something completely low cut and the sheer. You know, she goes about wearing camisole underneath. She has a lot of points. You guys went over most of it, though, as far as, like, sheer stuff.
Maybe we should do the blog instead. Yeah. I mean, so...
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to mention, I think she has a post also about pantyhose versus no pantyhose. I think it's more of what you're comfortable with. And, you know, as far as how your legs look, you know, some people have varicose veins and whatnot, and they want to cover it up.
Yeah, but that's not a summer issue. Any employer...
pantyhose are almost out the window except in the wintertime.
Well, I was going to say, any employer that requires a woman to wear pantyhose when it's 95 degrees should be prosecuted. Hey, Jane Ann, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
You know, Christopher just sent a great email talking about how everybody's got tattoos now. Young people have tattoos. So that's a big issue in the summertime, too, displaying the tattoo that you might not see in the wintertime.
People have to get over that. But I mean, this whole notion. I mean, if you have a teardrop under your eye, that's one thing. But beyond that, I mean, this whole debate about tattoos
about
showing
your
or not showing.
Pisces sign underneath your eye?
What is it? Mike Tyson has the thing, has the little waves coming out from under one eye. Maybe that's an issue. Beyond that, we should get over it. 877-301-8970. We're talking about appropriate summer attire, particularly, what is it, 93 today? It was 95 yesterday. Rules have got to be relaxed.
I think you are wrong about that. I think lots of people haven't gotten over the tattoos.
No, I'm saying they should. I'm not saying that they have.
Yeah, it's a big debate among mothers I know. When your 16-year-old girl wants to get a tattoo, your 18-year-old, when they're 18, they can go get it by themselves.
It's not a teen issue anymore. All of the mothers about whom you were speaking. No, I'm serious. Virtually all the mothers are tattooed. It's yesterday's issue. Kathy, you're in Seekonk.
You're
on with Jim and Marjorie
crazy.
On Boston Public Radio. Hey, Kathy.
Hey, Kathy.
Hi.
Hey.
I'm a retired teacher, and I think I probably speak for a lot of people. Being really rather appalled at the attire of student teachers. And I think this goes a bit beyond just appearing inappropriately because they're role models for a very vulnerable population and, you know, are often bending over and scooting down and whatnot, wearing cut tops down to who knows where and skirts up to who knows where. And I think it's a real problem.
Kathy, what do you think about student teachers with tattoos?
I'm not as worried about that as much as I am about their breast hanging out or their rear ends hanging out.
I think we got the point, Kathy. Thank you very much. So I think the key is student teachers should stand upright at all times. Is the
what about
Kathy
muffin?
Thanks.
We haven't mentioned muffin tops.
That's a great expression.
Yeah. What do you think of those?
You know, by the way, I don't think anything about them. I'll tell you what I do think about. This is one of these areas where common sense should determine everything. I mean, employers should use common sense. Employees should use common sense.
Well, you know.
It's pretty basic.
Why this is happening, though. I mean, you used to have to go to school and you used to have to there was a strict dress code. Now the dress codes are out the window in a lot of schools. So we've had this discussion before. You go to the bar mitzvah, you go to the junior prom, the senior prom, and you stand there with your camera taking pictures of your kids going to the prom. And you look at these young girls and you think, oh my God, you know, we would have called them hookers when we were, they're dressed.
Yeah, until someone makes the observation, hey, that young girl looks exactly like her mother. Marilyn Shrewsbury,
hold on. But then they carry that to the office. So they carry the same sort of hooker dressing that they're doing in the high schools to work. And when you tell your daughters you can't wear that to work, they look at you like, oh, Mom, you know, you're old-fashioned. You don't know what you're talking about. And they show up to work at the office until somebody tells them they're oblivious, Jim.
Marilyn Shrewsbury, you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Meryl. Hi, Meryl.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the whole tattoo thing in the workplace.
Please.
Yes.
I actually just got a full sleeve a few weeks ago, and I work in the medical field, so I have to wear scrubs every day. But the first few days wore a long suture underneath, and then I realized that it happens, and people should be more open to it now.
So how do you said you have a full sleeve. I almost lost you at the beginning there. So do your bosses frown upon that, or is the notion as long as you're providing good medical care, who cares?
As long as it's not offensive and vulgar, no naked chicks, no squares, nothing like that. They don't care.
Okay.
Are you a nurse, Meryl?
I'm going to be a nurse. I'm a dialysis tech as of right now.
So how do you feel about that, Marjorie? You're the tattoo phobic soul. How do you feel
about
that?
I'm not tattoo phobic. I think it's much more controversial than you think. I think a lot of mothers are not thrilled when their daughters go out and get a tattoo.
Who's talking about daughters? We're talking about humans, adults who are going to work.
I don't think
the issue is what Meryl's mother thinks about her.
I don't know that
I think
many
what the
50-year-old women that are going out
Meryl,
to get tattoos
can I ask,
for the first
you
time.
Ordinarily wouldn't do this. How old are you?
years old.
She's 20 years old. She's not a kid, Marjorie. This isn't about her mother. She's an adult who is training to become a nurse. What, Merle? I'm sorry.
Sorry, my mom wasn't happy when I got it. Of course, any mom wouldn't be. But a lot of the people that I deal with in the workplace are older, and they actually they like it. They always ask me, always, what's on it? When am I going to get it finished? Am I going to get any more? So, and they're elder people.
Jim,
I want to ask you what Albert is.
On.
Merle, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Let's get down to brass tacks here. I mean, you seem very emotional about this tattoo issue.
I'm deeply emotional about it.
Do you have a few tattoos you'd like to tell listeners about?
No, I don't, but I feel a really strong bond to Mike Tyson. And so I really, it's because of that that
okay.
I...
Are you contemplating a sleeve?
I'm not contemplating anything, but apparently I'm more open-minded than you are.
When you wear your shorts to work next week, we'll see a little tattoo handiwork that you've acquired.
Can I tell you something, Marty? I
have
very good news, so you're not going to have to wait till next week. What day is tomorrow? Wednesday?
It's going to
be in the high
80s.
I will be all shorted up. And I will.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know what we'll do to start tomorrow's show so people have something to look forward to? At 12:06 or 7 when we come on the air, you can do a review of how I look. By the way, the new shorts, just to give you a heads up, are plaid.
Oh, really?
They're like a brownish plaid, and they look quite nice.
With matching teardrops
on
your calves?
You'll find out tonight.
Okay. We're going to change gears for a second here. This is a much more serious story than what we've been talking about. Because last week, a 25-year-old young man from Bridgewater was killed in a car crash because he was texting. Tomorrow on Beacon Hill, the House is going to introduce legislation that will allow only hands-free use of cell phones while driving and to increase penalties for texting while driving. And a Senate bill aims to ban the use of mobile phones altogether. What do you think? Should all phone communications be banned behind the wheel? That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with me, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan is right across from me. In our former radio lives, Marjorie and I advocated really hard for the distracted driving law that passed, I think, 3 years ago. Part of it banned texting while driving, though we don't think it cracked down hard enough on inept older drivers. That's a topic for another day. Back to texting. Everybody still does it. I don't care what anybody says. A recent poll said 40% admitted to the dangerous behavior, but the numbers are huge. Yet only an average of 4 citations a day are issued across Massachusetts. Marjorie, you just mentioned last week a young guy from West Bridgewater died in a car crash. The cause is texting while driving, and in part that's why tomorrow at the State House there'll be legislation proposed from the House to ban texting while driving and to crack down harder on those that do, also to do totally hands-free use of cell phones. The Senate, at least one person in the Senate, wants to go further and ban using cell phones while driving altogether. We want to know what your take is on this. How far do we need to go? 877-301-8970. Some people think, you know, what is it? Tuning the radio while driving, listening to audiobooks while driving is just as dangerous. But the notion that we can't move to either hands-free or banning the use of phones altogether and just pull to the side
of
the road and
use them. Do you want to ban the use of
phones
altogether?
No, I want to do hands-free as the next step.
Yeah, well, the problem with hands-free is that this, and I suspected this all along, as a matter of fact, I think other people have done the same studies, but in yet another study by the American Automobile Association, AAA, that lots of us belong to, says driver voice commands and hands-free devices are just as dangerous as texting. So I don't want to get rid of cell phones. I mean, I think most of us, you know, every time you're going on a long drive somewhere and you have an hour on the Mass Pike or something, you get a lot of your phone calling done on the Mass Pike. When you're in the middle, you're going 60 miles an hour, or in your case, 50 miles an hour, and you get your business done. Texting,
what's the problem with it, Marjorie, though, under existing law? The reason there's so few citations is because a police officer cannot tell if you're dialing a phone number, which is legal, or if you are texting. And so this notion, with all due respect to AAA, let me just finish this thought. They have no idea what they're talking about.
A phone number.
Well, it's the law.
Online.
You can right now.
When you're behind the wheel.
You know how you avoid that? Hands-free. Now, they say it's just as dangerous. And my assumption, because it's ridiculous that it could be, is that it's just as dangerous because we're not used to doing hands-free. Once people get used to the technology, by definition. If you don't have to look at something, you can keep looking at the road. If you don't have to look down, how long does the average text take? Did you read this morning? 4.6 seconds.
It's
during
too long.
4.6
yeah,
seconds, if you're driving 60 miles an hour, that's 3 or 4 football fields. By definition, if you have hands free and you learn how to use it, you're going to be less distracted. 877-301-8970. There's several questions. One, do you text while driving? Tell the truth. I have to tell you, when I'm driving either slowly or I'm at a stoplight, where, by the way, you're still considered driving, you look in every direction. Every single driver is texting. Should we keep the law as it is? Should we at least try this hands-free thing, which is what somebody from the House is proposing? Or do we go the whole nine yards and say you just simply can't use your cell phone? I assume the exception is for 911 while you're driving. 877-301-8970. But to call, you have to tell the truth. You have to promise to tell the truth. Do you text while driving? You have to raise your right hand while you're answering the question.
Do you text while driving, Jim?
I do it a lot less than I used to. That's an honest answer,
okay,
isn't it?
Do you want to get rid of cell phones in the car?
No, I want to do the. I told you, I want to do the middle thing. I want to do hands-free. By the way, I occasionally do hands-free, and I understand where AAA is coming from, which is when you haven't done hands-free a lot, it's fairly cumbersome at first. But once you do it a while and you understand the technology, it is insane to suggest that you're anywhere nearly as distracted as you are
if
you're punching numbers or letters into a thing.
Because millions and millions of new cars are coming with this hands-free technology already equipped. They're already in the car, so lots of people are going to be using it, whether the AAA says it's more dangerous or not. But the thing that I think you have to remember, and it's brought back in these tragedies where a kid, an 18-year-old, who actually got sent to jail for causing an accident that he was texting, when they did the investigation, he texted at say 34 past the hour, received the message, the reply at 35 past the hour, which is the same time the accident happened. So, they can nail you on these kinds of things, even if you don't, let's hope you don't, get into a very serious accident.
No, they
even
only
if you get
nail
into a
you.
Minor accident.
No, but they nail you when something horrible has happened.
Right.
The goal is to stop you before something horrible
happens.
That's
the thing. That's the thing. I mean, it's a great argument to use with your kids. If you text while driving, and God forbid nothing terrible happens, but even if you hit somebody's bumper in front of you, as someone I know has done on many occasions, hit the bumper in front of you.
Not while I'm texting.
No, you're on the telephone.
Maybe it's while I'm on the telephone.
Okay.
Margaret, your segment is not about me.
I know.
It's about the concept of texting or using a cell phone.
I like to point these little things out.
Thank you.
When you do that, you could cause an accident, and then the insurance company may have a very difficult time paying up on the claim if you're breaking the law while you're behind the wheel.
877-301-8970. I want to reiterate what I said. Under existing law, the average number of citations from police officers to texters a day in Massachusetts is 4. An average of 4, which is proof on its face that the law is simply not working.
Listen to what Keith said. He was driving on Route 3 yesterday and he's at the highway speeds, and he saw a woman that was texting while driving with 2 small children in the car.
Can I tell you something? If they know that she was texting, and I'm not a one-and-done kind of person, take away her license for 6 months. I mean, it's one thing if you want to endanger yourself and you're endangering other drivers. You have kids in the car. It's outrageous. This whole texting. Can I say one last thing about this? I realize there's another thing the legislature can do. Is we discussed this 2 or 3 months ago on the air. They can mandate this technology where your phone is connected. I don't mean literally, but it is linked to your gas pedal. And if you're going faster than, I don't know what the number is, 5 or 10 miles an hour, it makes your texting function inoperable.
Yeah.
I mean, something has to happen.
That's a great
idea. I know it is. And we discussed it. We had somebody in the air in our former lives who ran some software company that had created this thing. The point is it's doable. The law as it exists was a feeble attempt to deal with a really serious problem. Let's go to the phones.
Kevin from Mendon, what do you think about banning cell phones altogether or banning texting altogether, Kevin?
Banning texting, yes, but not cell phones. I'm calling you right now using hands-free while driving.
And did it distract you to do it, Kevin, or no?
No, I pressed a button on the steering wheel. I announced your number. It dialed it, and I got through.
How about that, Marjorie?
Wow, you press a button on the steering wheel.
Yeah, my phone is linked by Bluetooth to the car radio. I hit a button on the steering wheel. This is common in most cars today. I announced the number I wanted it to dial, your phone number. It dialed it. I went through.
What do you have to say, Marjorie, and that other guy on the radio? Is that what the listing is, or what is it?
However, wait a minute. I will tell you, in my town 2 weeks ago, we had a 16 or 18-year-old girl kill a pedestrian, and she told the police she was bending down to look at her GPS.
Oh.
While driving. I don't like texting while driving. I have an iPhone. I have hit the button and asked Siri to text somebody, told Siri what to text, and to do it. But I won't look at the actual keyboard and try to do it while driving.
You know, Kevin, I'm so glad you called. Admittedly, thanks for the call. While you're obviously your personal situation is anecdotal, I think you're typical. This AAA survey, I don't get at all. It is, you know, we talked about common sense when we're talking about appropriate clothing mm-hmm. at the office.
Right.
It is common sense. If you were looking at a keypad as opposed to just looking ahead at the traffic and speaking, which is going to be less risky? Obviously, the looking ahead and speaking. So hands-free is what this legislature has got to do. They completely wimped out on older drivers, at least older drivers who were inept.
Oh, gosh.
Let's hope they don't wimp out on texting a second time. By the way, 40-some states ban texting while driving. I can't believe all 50 do. Massachusetts, and this is sort of a sad case, we were in the last wave of states. I think 30-some states had already banned texting while driving before we came to the party.
Let's go to Shayla on Route 128 in Burlington. What do you think, Shayla?
Well, I think that once we start getting into banning things in the car, I ate an ice cream in the car last night. I got an ice cream and I asked them to put the cone on top of the cup. And I was driving along ridiculously trying to scoop the ice cream from the cup into my cone while I was driving. I stopped myself. And I said, oh, my God, this is just crazy. I hate that it's going to melt on the way home, but, you know, it's just going to have to do that. My point is, really, how much do we want to get into banning things like eating or turning around and trying to put the pacifier back in your baby's mouth or, you know, all of the things that pull our attention away from the road in front of us. And there are plenty of them. Putting, you know, sugar in your coffee after you've gotten it going through the drive-through.
Well, let me start for Shayla. If I were the police officer, I would have snatched the cone out of your hand. That's number one. No, seriously, Shayla, the reality is I think you can't say it's a 100% either-or situation. If it's proven, I don't know if you're aware, out of Virginia Tech, this is about 2 or 3 years ago. Actually, it was before we passed the law in Massachusetts. They concluded, based on hard data, that texting while driving was as dangerous a behavior as drunk driving. And I would say that eating while driving, probably not a great thing, but I don't think there's any evidence that even comes close
but
to being
also,
that risk laden.
I think it's the physical thing that you're doing. I mean, think about this. When you are texting, you have to look at your phone. You have to find the T. You have to find the G.
And you're probably making
your
mistakes.
Your finger is too big to fit around the T or the G anyway, which is why I should figure that out, make that easy for people. But that's the problem. And then you have to erase the mistakes and all that kind of stuff. It's a very – as opposed to like if we all have done this with kids in the back seat, you're reaching behind to look for the baby bottle. You're reaching behind to look for the pacifier, as Shayla said. That's sort of like reaching while you get your hands and your eyes on the road.
You know, we need hands-free ice cream cone eating. That's the solution, Shayla, for your dilemma. Let's try – where are we going? We're going to Tom. I don't know where you are, Tom, but you're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Tom. Whoa. Hi, Tom. Well, that was painful there.
We lost Tom.
Let's go to Bill in Worcester. Bill, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marjorie. Hey there, Bill.
This is Will.
Will. Hi,
Will.
Say hi to Bill for us. Go ahead. Go.
That's right. I just wanted to point out the fact that I drive a lot, and you can do a lot of other things other than texting on your phone that distracts you, such as reading email, looking at things like beat the traffic is a biggie. You know, you see the traffic piling up in front of you, so you go on the app, beat the traffic, and see how long that is. Should I take an exit off now, or should I keep going?
Hold on for a second, Will. What is beat the traffic? Is that a website, please? Beatthetraffic.com?
It's an app.
An app? Better get one of those.
And it'll show you a map of what highway you're on, and it'll turn different colors to tell you what the speed of the traffic is.
Yeah.
And so when I see that I'm about to hit a big traffic jam and I'm near an exit, I like to get on there and see whether it's practical to get off or keep going.
But your point is it's distracting because you're looking at a screen as opposed to looking in the road. Bill, it's a horrible connection, so we have to let you go. Thank you so much. I mean, the problem is, and this gets back to what Shayla and Will, my apologies, are both saying, is virtually anything you do when you take your eyes off the road is a real serious problem, whether it's to look at your kid in the back seat, to look at the radio dial, but texting, because of how long it takes, think how long, the average text, I want to repeat, is 4.6 seconds, according to all these studies. 4.6 seconds. Count it out. One, two, three. I mean, it's a long period of time. It's not like just turning around and putting the pacifier in the kid's mouth. Why are you looking
at
me?
No, it's because you have to look down. I just got a text, speaking of text, from a motorcycle rider who says that he has to be very conscious, obviously, because he's vulnerable on the road. And he said, and this is a great point, almost every time he sees a distracted driver, he looks in and that person is on the phone.
No, so, it's horrible.
There you go.
Well, the reality is, again, the legislature is going to hold hearings tomorrow. The House bill would mandate, a House bill would mandate hands-free. A Senate bill would mandate no cell phone use at all in the car. We promise we will keep you apprised of what happens up there on Beacon Hill.
When we come back, we're going to get a sneak preview. If you haven't heard of these, they're great. The 16th Annual Muzzle Awards, the enemies of free speech and personal liberties all throughout New England. WGBH regular Dan Kennedy joins us for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. He's the man behind a great blog, Media Nation. He teaches at Northeastern. He's a regular on Beat the Press. He's got a new book called Wired City. We'll talk about that in a minute. And along with the great Harvey Silverglade, he's the person behind the 16th Annual Muzzle Awards, which shows that while its closure was a cause for great sadness, there is some life, at least, after the Boston Phoenix. Good to see you, Dan Kennedy.
Well, thanks, Jim. Thanks, Marjorie.
Hi, Dan. So for people who don't know, what, please, are the Muzzle Awards, Dan Kennedy?
The Muzzle Awards, which I guess we could say are venerable at this point.
Yes.
We started doing them in 1998. Is a 4th of July roundup of outrages against free speech in New England. Most of them tend to be in Greater Boston, but really all of New England is our play field.
And while this used to be a Boston Phoenix project, it's now a WGBH project, correct?
It is, although the Portland Phoenix and the Providence Phoenix are still alive and well, and they're collaborating with us on this.
Okay, I don't know if they're in any order in particular, but Marjorie and I read through your 16th annual muzzles, and the ones we wanted to start with were the ones at the top. I don't know if she's number one or she just happens to be listed first. U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, why did she reach that plateau? Why'd she get an award?
Well, you know, although they're not ranked, I guess I would say that Carmen Ortiz was number one, and this is her second year in a row in the pole position. Last year it was for the Tarek Mehanna case. This year it is for her prosecution of the late Aaron Swartz, the young internet prodigy who committed suicide while he was being threatened with a fairly lengthy prison stay.
35 years.
By her office. That was in the press release, but at best he was still going to do 6 months if he pleaded guilty to the charges that she brought against him, which he thought were completely unjust.
Yeah, I don't know that her – there was a lot of talk about Carmen Ortiz going on to becoming the governor of Massachusetts or some segueing from the U.S. attorney's office into some other position, a la Bill Weld. I think she was severely hurt by this heavy-duty prosecution of this young man who I think most people couldn't really get. I mean, you understood he wasn't supposed to take these records and he wasn't supposed to download these things onto his computer. But you didn't – jail time. I mean, jail time. When people that commit violent crimes go to jail, and this guy was going to go facing jail time.
The company whose property that he downloaded to his computer, JSTOR, which is an academic publishing company, declined to press charges. Mm-hmm. And yet she jumped in and decided to press charges. And it would seem that to some extent it was motivated by his political position, which is he was a very strong believer that all this information ought to be freely available without charge to anybody, and I think she saw this as a threat to the established order. And there you go.
I think she does deserve the top spot. And by the way, if you don't know, Aaron Swartz, I don't know if you said this, was 26 years old when he took his own life. Dan, who's the juror? Is this like a Harvey Silverglade, Dan Kennedy, everybody else stay out of the room kind of thing? Who makes makes the determinations here?
Well, you know, it's sort of a group decision. I compile the list throughout the year, and then I put together what I think ought to be the 10, and a number of people have input into it. What was great about it this year is that, you know, Peter Kadzis, who always had the last say at the Phoenix, is now here at WGBH,
right.
Yes, he is.
And he was involved in helping to refine the list, edit the story. It was just like old home week.
So let's move on to one that I had forgotten about. Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis, why does he make the Muzzle Award this year?
And by the way, I want to point out that, you know, we have some very nice things to say about Commissioner Davis and his handling of the Boston Marathon and the aftermath. I mean, I think he and all the first responders did a terrific job. But last fall, the ACLU of Massachusetts and the National Lawyers Guild were able to get some documents showing that the Boston police had been essentially spying on a number of anti-war activists, including, the late but at the time elderly World War II hero Howard Zinn. I mean, it was just absolutely absurd.
What does that mean, spying? What were they doing?
Well, they were compiling information on anti-war activities, Occupy activities. At one point, they delivered a whole report of an anti-war rally that took place at a church in Jamaica Plain, and described it as, you know, potentially quite a dangerous activity. And meanwhile, you know, this information was given to the Fusion Center. And meanwhile, the Fusion Center can't even get information that Russian intelligence was giving us about the Tsarnaev brothers. That would have been, you know, that would have been useful information.
Yeah. I'm surprised by I'm surprised by all this, I guess. Somehow I think, naively, obviously, that this kind of thing doesn't go on that
well,
much.
Well, you know, the U.S. attorney thing, Carmen Ortiz and Aaron Swartz, it's another case, an extreme case of overzealous prosecution. But this one, what's the rationale? I don't know, and I'm embarrassed that I don't. Has Davis or the police department, they commented on why they did this and what the rationale was?
Well, in the coverage that I tracked, and there was a Globe story and a number of other stories, I have not seen any comment from law enforcement as to why they were doing this. But I mean, you know, the three of us are all certainly old enough to remember when law enforcement was doing this against anti-war protesters in the 1960s, and it didn't make any sense then either. I mean, the Occupy movement, obviously, there were moments where it looked like it might get out of control,
right.
So I guess you can understand why they might have been keeping an eye on them, although, in fact, it never happened. They were...
No, and also they should be commended, too, because you know, there was a pretty good relationship for the most part between the cops that were patrolling down at the Occupy site down by South Station and the people that were there for the most part. It was pretty good until...
Yes, there was, and you're right, and in fact, better in Boston than it was in many other cities.
Yep, yep.
Before we get to others on your list, we're talking to Dan Kennedy, by the way, and you know we've ID'd him from the 42 things that he does in his average day, but he's also with Harvey Silverlegate, the men behind the Muzzle Awards, the 16th annual Muzzle Awards, New Englanders who have, I guess, stepped on people's free speech rights. Can I make a nomination for next year before you... You continue this list?
All nominations are welcome.
You're looking aghast that I'm about to. And you may have done this in the past. One of the things we discuss a lot here on the air and up in the newsroom is the outrage that we continue to be barred from bringing electronic broadcasting things into federal courtrooms.
Oh.
Whether it's to the Supreme Court, so you can actually see them deciding the Voting Rights Act, like they when they announce their decision today, or DOMA and Prop 8 tomorrow or the next day, oral argument, or the Whitey Bulger trial, or the Sal DeMasi trial. There, you know, it is unbelievable to me, and I think all of us, and I think I speak for Emily Rooney in this case, too,
you
in 2013.
You absolutely speak for Emily.
It's obscene.
And me.
What's the rationale? I mean, what is the rationale, Dan?
Just for a second. Think of it. What a learning lesson this would be if you could go home at night. You could DVR it during the day, go home at night, see John Monerano on the witness stand, a guy who allegedly killed, well, not allegedly, he's admitted
he pled guilty
20,
to it.
20 people, if Whitey Bulger ever takes a stand. I mean, this is like an American civics lesson, and all we're able to get is a secondhand report unless you physically go down to the overflow space in the courtroom and hope that you are there in time to get in. It's just driving me crazy.
It should drive you crazy, and I don't understand the rationale for it. The Massachusetts state courts are actually pretty progressive now when it comes to putting things on TV. And, gee, you know, our justice system doesn't seem to have fallen apart over that. The idea that we have this epic case taking place right now, and where all we can do is rely on Twitter during the day, and some people are doing a great job on Twitter, but I mean, this should be on TV.
Yeah, well, you know, but I want to
just
add,
just before we leave this, it's not just the civics lesson, even though I totally agree with you. Prosecutions are done in our name. When the United States government decides to prosecute Whitey Bulger or Aaron Swartz or whomever, they do it in the name of Dan Kennedy, Marjorie Egan, Jim Brown, and everybody else. We have a right to see what's being done in our own name. I mean, that's pretty basic.
We're the taxpayers. We're funding the whole thing.
Okay, fine. So what else? What's your – I was going to say favorite. It's a very poor choice of words. We talked about the Boston Police Commissioner. We've talked about U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz. Give us another one that drove you crazy this year, Dan Kennedy.
Well, I think one that drove me particularly crazy was our now third-time muzzle winner, Governor Paul LePage of Maine, who has gotten in considerably more trouble than he'd been in even when I was writing this a couple of weeks ago over some extremely crude comments he made.
But, really?
Oh,
do tell.
This is public radio. I can't say.
Well, not the crude comment, but what was it involving? Tell people who don't know.
What he earned his muzzle for was that the Bangor Daily News filed a Freedom of Information Act request for information about people who had concealed weapons permits. Mm-hmm. And this happened right after the situation in New York where the paper in White Plains did the map and put all
yes.
of the... Now, the Bangor Daily News had no intention of doing that. They were up to something else, but they've said we would not have done that. There was just a freak out among legislators, especially on the Republican side, and Governor LePage ends up having himself photographed with his holding up his concealed weapon permit, basically saying, you know, you want it, come and get it. And by spring, the legislature had rushed through and the governor had signed a bill removing these records from the public sphere, so they are no longer public records.
Didn't he also, in addition to what language you do want to say on the air, I think I'm right. In the last couple of weeks, didn't this press secretary announce, this is Governor LePage in Maine, didn't she announce that there's certain newspapers to whom they would not respond to any inquiries, not about this, about anything, they would delete them from their press list. Am I not right about that?
You are correct. The Portland Press Herald and two of its sister papers, the governor said he would no longer deal with. Now, interestingly enough...
He's a fascinating character, is he not?
Well, another muzzle goes to former New Hampshire House Speaker Bill O'Brien for holding an official news conference in his office and barring the Concord Monitor. Now, that is arguably a violation of the First Amendment because you can't exclude any one player in the media. What LePage did probably passes constitutional muster because all he's saying is we're not going to do you any favors. But nevertheless, it certainly wasn't a great moment for the governor.
Dan, if people want to read all of the winners, and I use the term loosely, the 10 winners of enemies of free speech and personal liberties throughout New England, the Muzzle Awards, is it at wgbhnews.org or is it about to be? Where is that?
My understanding is it's going to be posted on Thursday. I haven't been told exactly where, but I guess it would be wgbhnews.org. Maybe it'll be on wgbh.org as well, but I don't know.
We're getting lots of head shakes, I should say, in the affirmative from our colleagues.
Oh, okay. See, you're looking in their direction.
You were right.
So wgbhnews.org. And we're just thrilled to bring them here.
We're thrilled to have
you. It's been great to have them at the Phoenix all these years, and to be able to bring WGBH into the picture is just terrific.
Okay, we're talking to Dan Kennedy from Northeastern University and also is a WGBH regular on Beat the Press every Friday night at 7 o'clock with Emily Rooney in Greater Boston. But I want to hear about your new book, Wired City. Now, I understand that I can be guardedly hopeful that there may be a future for the newspaper business in some sort of different format. Please do tell. What's Wired City?
Well, the Wired City is largely about New Haven, where you have a large daily newspaper that its parent company has gone through bankruptcy twice in recent years. And since 2005, the city has been very well served by this startup, nonprofit, online-only news site called the New Haven Independent. And, you know, they have a staff of four full-time people running around the city on their bikes. If you want to be hopeful, do you ride a bike, Marjorie?
I do. Not for a while, but I do know how.
She will if it'll help, Dan. Trust
okay,
me.
So there you go. So you're all set. And they are just doing an absolutely terrific job covering city politics, police, and neighborhood news. And
with four people?
Well, you know, it's four, but, you know, it sounds like, oh, my God, how can they keep up with a newsroom of 80, which the New Haven Register has? But the fact is, the New Haven Register has maybe four or five people covering the city of New Haven.
So, but Dan, with I guess the bottom line question is the bottom line. With ad revenues declining, with circulation of at least hard copy newspapers, how are they keeping this thing financially afloat?
Well, what they're doing is, obviously, by getting rid of the paper part of it, you cut your cost to the bone. So just about every nickel they raise is able to go into the journalism. It's foundation grants. It's donations from wealthy individuals. It's sponsorships from institutions in the community, colleges, hospitals, and the like. It's very similar to the public radio model, except that you're not you don't need to raise nearly as much money. And as part of this, I also did look at some for-profit news sites. And some of them are doing a terrific job, too, running out, selling advertising. But it's a harder slog at this point. The nonprofits, some of the larger nonprofits, of which New Haven is one, are able to raise more money than the for-profits, which basically have to hit every pizza shop and tattoo parlor in town.
Now, are these four people riding around on bicycles covering fires and murders? Are they earning a living wage or minimum wage, or what's their deal?
They are absolutely earning a living wage.
Good.
They are making no sacrifice working for the Independent as opposed to a comparable community
newspaper. That's
great, newspaper.
Because that's the problem.
I mean, none of us are getting rich in this business and never did, but their pay is comparable to what you would make at a medium-sized newspaper.
And by the way, we should say the Globe Review and a few others I've read have been sparkling. They've said the book is a great piece of work by you, Dan Kennedy.
And you can read all of Dan Kennedy's Muzzle Awards on Thursday when they go live on our website. I think you guys said this before, wgbhnews.org. And congratulations, Dan Kennedy, in writing this new book, The
Wired
City.
Where do you find
City.
It, by the way? Where do you find it?
Yeah,
Wired
where
City,
do you find
Dan
it?
Kennedy?
It's on Amazon, hoping to get it into bookstores. You can also go to thewiredcity.org.
Dan, it's great to see you.
And you can keep
good
up with
you.
Dan's great media criticism at dankennedy.net. Is that
well,
correct?
Thank you. Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you very much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you. It's Plugola Day. thank you. I really
plug
appreciate it.
Plug it all. Absolutely. We don't want to leave any stone unturned or any plug unmade. Okay, up next, the man who brought us The Social Network and Sex on the Moon. Now he brings us the story of six college kids who built an online poker empire. Writer Ben Mesrick joins us next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We're joined by one of Boston's most prolific and most celebrated writers, and for good reason. He's brought us Bringing Down the House, The Accidental Billionaire, is my personal favorite. I hope I can say that, Sex on the Moon, which I loved. For his most recent, he returns to some similar themes, a pod of wunderkinds, lots of money, lots of risks and suspense. It's called, it's a long title, Straight Flush, the true story of six college friends who dealt their way to a billion-dollar online poker empire and how it all came crashing down. He would be called Ben Mesrick. Ben, it's great to see you again.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, prolific, absolutely. You are one busy guy over there.
I don't get out much.
Yeah,
right.
So give people the synopsis of the new book.
Well, Straight Flush is about a group of frat brothers from the University of Montana, and these were, you know, regular jock guys from poor families for the most part, who would play poker in a local bar. And they decided to try and put it online, and they moved their fraternity to Costa Rica. And over a number of years, they built it into a $1 million-a-day poker empire. And then online poker became illegal. and now they're all fugitives. So it's kind of a rise and fall kind of story where they end up, you know, on the run.
Yeah,
and by the way, this is real. For those who don't know, we didn't say this. This happened, and they're fugitives. Were they in Costa Rica?
One of them is in Antigua. So Antigua protects him. Well, Antigua believes that online poker should be legal. They fought it in the WTO. They don't feel like the U.S. has any reason to make it illegal. So they're willing to put him up, so they won't extradite him.
You know, one of the things I don't understand and is okay, they started their business before this 2006 change in the law. So couldn't they just say, okay, the law's changed now?
Well, they stayed in business. So what happened was in 2006, most of the companies left the American market because it was obviously going to be dangerous. These guys stayed. PokerStars stayed. And another company called Full Tilt stayed. These guys were Absolute Poker. So these three companies stayed, took over the whole American market. But at that point, they were committing this crime is a strong word. I don't feel like it was a crime, but it was certainly against a certain rule.
How do these guys like this book? I assume they've all read it, yes?
Yes, they are very much, they love it. There's things in it that they don't like. Nobody's a saint in this story. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of drugs, there's a lot of girls, there's a lot of sort of mismanaged money, I guess you would say. But overall, they like the idea that the story is getting out because they believe that these anti-online poker laws are hypocritical. I mean, we all line up for lottery tickets, right? Powerball is the biggest thing in the world, but we're not allowed to play poker. Doesn't make a lot of sense. So they would like that story to get out.
Go ahead, Marjorie.
I was just going to ask you, so what happens to these guys? I mean, if you get a movie, you've been very successful getting your books made into movies. Do they get a cut of the movie to support themselves?
Well,
they're supporting themselves in exile.
Well, first of all, the one in exile, I think, has a fair amount of money. You have to remember, this was a $1 million-a-day business with no board of directors and nobody watching. So who knows how much he has in a pile there.
So I shouldn't feel that sorry for him.
I wouldn't feel sorry
then,
for
in
anybody
Antigua.
In the story. But when a movie gets made, they usually sell their life rights to the studio. They get a piece of the movie in terms of, you know, when Hollywood makes a movie, they want to own all the life rights.
Were you thinking, you know, I've had this discussion with you before in the time of obviously The Social Network we all know about what that was about, Facebook guy. I want to talk about him in a second because I don't quite get him and you know him very well. Are you thinking movie when you sit down to write one of these books? Do you say to yourself, I'm not just writing for the reader, I am writing because I think there's a great movie in this thing. Is that part of your mindset?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm picturing Robert Pattinson running around. You know, I've always been very cinematic. I've sat down to write books knowing that, you know, there's a real synergy nowadays, especially the kind of stuff I write. You kind of have to be thinking movie.
Sex on the Moon is essentially about this love story around the theft of moon rocks. Is that a fair? I mean, it's a great book. And when I'm reading that, I'm saying, I cannot wait to see this on the screen. 6 or 8 months ago, I read that there was this big deal you got or somebody got. What's happening with
it? So I sold it to Sony, who did The Social Network, and it's Scott Rudin, Kevin Spacey are producing it as well. And Will Glick, who did Friends with Benefits and Easy A, is writing the screenplay. And
so it's going to happen.
I believe it will. You know, you never know in Hollywood until they actually start shooting, but it looks pretty good. So I think sooner or later that'll get made.
And before we get to Mark Zuckerberg, you wanted to pursue that, Mark
Zuckerberg.
I do. There are probably all these people that are listening to you right now, Ben Mezrich, who are thinking to themselves, I want to be Ben Mezrich. So when you were, a good writer in high school? I mean, I know you went to Harvard, so you're obviously smart.
Right.
But I mean, how did you get from being, you know,
Ben Mezrich.
I'm still little Ben Mezrich. I think I'm just very geeky. I sat in my room and I wrote. And I've wanted to be a writer since I was
12. When were you sitting in your room writing?
I started at 12.
12, okay.
And I wrote my first book at 12. I've always been books. And when I graduated from college, I knew this is what I wanted to do. So I locked myself in a room in the Back Bay. And I wrote 9 novels over 2 years. Were rejected by everybody. No one bought them. And then eventually, I wrote one book that got sold. And it started when I was 24.
So how were you supporting yourself while you were writing the 9 novels?
Very poorly. I worked for City Year in Boston. You know that public service.
Oh gosh,
my kid just graduated 2 weeks ago. I didn't know you were a City Year kid.
I wrote their brochures. They might
really?
Still use the brochures. I worked for Alan Dershowitz at Harvard Law School. I was one of his research assistants. I worked. You know, you do. Boston is a great city to be a struggling writer. It's not like New York where you're living in this tiny, you know, horrible apartment and starving. In Boston, you can get jobs.
So you had like a day job.
I had a lot of day jobs. None of them were.
So when did you do the writing? Did you do the writing at 5 o'clock in the morning before you went to your
day
job?
I will
honestly
say that I was a horrible employee at all of my day jobs. I wrote at work. I wrote at night. I wrote pretty much all the time. I would play hooky from work and write. And until I sold a book. You know, it was touch and go a bit. but my parents were not going to let me starve. I mean,
That's
my
good.
Parents, you know, were very helpful in that. They gave me a time limit. They said 2 years if you don't have real progress, you need to go to graduate
school.
And
at the end of 2 years, you'd sold the book.
I had an agent. By the end of the 2 years, I signed an agent, and they would let me, you know, survive a little longer, and then I sold the book.
This is a tutorial for Marjorie. That's why she's
asking the questions. Doesn't everybody want to write a book?
Well, my parents were not thrilled with my decision when I first graduated from college, because I graduated, and I said, I want to be a writer. And they said, no, go to law school, go to this, go to that. And I said, no, I want to be a writer. And it wasn't for a number of years that they were happy with my decisions.
We're talking to Ben
Mesrick. His latest book is called Straight Flush. I want to get to Mark Zuckerberg in a second because whatever. Before we do that, earlier in the show, we were discussing appropriate summer attire. And we were discussing whether or not men could get away with wearing shorts. You were wearing, what's that color?
You know what? I think I just gave up. These are pink. I don't know. Fuchsia.
Well, pinkish.
I don't know. My wife picks all my outfits.
This is
so
Tanya.
If you're
going to
blame anyone, it's Tanya. And you know Tanya. She's fashion.
So there's. Oh, actually, the producers are saying they're salmon shorts.
Salmon. That's right.
Now, did you think
correct.
Twice
they're
before
salmon.
You made this decision, or you,
you
just went ahead with
I
it?
I have a toddler, a 3-year-old toddler, and he has the exact same shorts. And sometimes we walk around wearing matching salmon shorts. So I have no.
Self-respect,
I guess is the word.
Mark Zuckerberg, whom I don't know, who you obviously know pretty intimately, and we know you wrote about him, and everybody has seen the movie.
Right.
From afar, he comes off to me as one of the most obnoxious young people in the history of humankind. I know that's hyperbolic. How far off am I?
No, I think you're right. Listen, no one knows Mark Zuckerberg intimately, actually, because he's a very closed-off, socially awkward individual. Mark was not happy that I wrote that book. Mm-hmm. Eduardo was the one who came to me. And I actually just ran into the Winklevi 2 days ago.
Oh,
twins!
Really?
I was eating lunch in L.A., and I was on my way out, and I look over, and they were sitting together at a table. They're the nicest guys. I was hanging out with them. They're very sweet.
These are the two guys, the brothers who sued...
Right. Identical twin Olympic rowers.
Okay. Greek gods.
You couldn't invent these guys if you wanted to. So Mark was not thrilled with the whole project at all, but he's a very kind of closed-off, socially awkward, strange individual who's also a genius. I mean, he is a genius. He's just... not someone you know you would be friends with, I don't think.
What are the Winklevi up to these days?
You know, they started a venture fund mostly with their money. So they ended up with about $200 million from Facebook.
Oh, so we shouldn't
worry
about them.
Oh, no, they're doing great. And so they're using that money to invest in bitcoins. That's their thing. That whole Bitcoin industry, whatever
that is.
So they're, venture capitalists, and they're living in L.A. now and going up and down to the valley, Silicon Valley, and that's what they're doing.
Bitcoins are what are funding, in part, Edward Snowden's
It's this kind of gray area finance. I don't know a lot about it, so I shouldn't,
So how is it working with the film industry? You always hear these stories about just vicious cutthroat. Everybody's
I've been doing well.
Meeting.
I just sold a big movie with Brett Ratner, the director, attached, which is going to be a trilogy of books. They're Da Vinci Code-esque thrillers about the seven wonders of the world.
Great.
So I'm doing that. I'm doing a lot more with movies. The industry is strange. It's different than it was, when I started 5 years ago. But it's still, it's kind of like the lottery. You go out there and you get lucky and something happens.
How's it different than it was 5 years ago?
I think back then studios were throwing money around a lot more.
Okay.
Now it's much more of a workload to get that offer. But once you get that offer, it's still a lot of fun.
We're talking to Ben Mesrick, whose latest book is called Straight Flush, and he is wearing salmon shorts. If I didn't make that clear, Coyote's blaming somebody else for it. The common threads in these books, these are brilliant young people. I mean, obviously with some exceptions, who take risks, who do things on the edges, many of whom become billionaires or very wealthy people. What's the vicarious deal? I mean, you're obviously doing very well. You've done it. I mean, there is you want to be some of these people.
I want to be. I'm incredibly jealous and envious of all of these people.
You mean that sincerely?
I was in a college dorm room right when the internet was being invented, and I missed the whole thing. I missed everything. I didn't go to Wall Street and start a hedge fund. I missed all of these things. And so when I see these guys who do it, I want to be like them. And so, it's very much an envy-driven thing.
On a serious note, I'm thinking as I'm looking at you, Ben, obviously I'm not going to give out your address. No, this is actually a serious thing. Do you not live, you live relatively near the marathon deal.
I live right on the finish line.
Were you in town for this?
No, thankfully I was in London and my family was in Miami. My apartment building became part of the crime scene. And
what's this been like? I mean, coming back.
Well, coming back was crazy because I came back Tuesday and my dog was in the apartment alone for a few days.
You mean the Tuesday after the marathon?
Yeah, the next day.
The dog was in the apartment?
So I was able to get in. I had to go through FBI checkpoints and get up there just to feed the dog. And then I stayed in there, and it was like a ghost town. And I mean, it was crazy. It was horrible. And I didn't want to look out the window because my windows overlooked
the Forum.
Yeah,
those
you
places.
Could see it. My Forum is right in front of the window. So, I mean, I'm just thankful that I wasn't around. And it was just, you know, it's crazy. I mean, it's ridiculous. I was luckily in London, but had I been there, I mean, you know, you just always think about where would I have been
Yeah.
had it happened. So, yeah.
So let's get back to when you were a 12-year-old writing all these novels up in
right.
your little room. Who'd you read? Who'd you read then?
Well,
when
I was 12, I mean, my parents had a rule that we had to read 2 books a week before we could watch TV.
Wow.
So I loved television. So I was a speed reader because I wanted to watch TV. So I read everything. My real influences came a little later. It was Bret Easton Ellis and Jay McInerney.
Oh, my goodness.
But I didn't end up writing like that. And then Michael Crichton. And when I discovered Michael Crichton, it was kind of, you know, and then Hunter S. Thompson was probably where I became as twisted as I, you know, I go in the kind of gonzo journalism way. But yeah. Yeah.
Who do you read today? Not as a little 12-year-old.
No,
you
know, I read everything. I just picked up the new Dan Brown just to see what it's all about.
He's Da Vinci Code.
Yeah. I've been reading a lot of... you know, it's hard for me to say one specific thing. I love zombie books. I don't know why. I
You've
got into
the zombie
Max
movie
Brooks,
with
the World War Z. That book, I think that's one of the best books that I've read
really?
in 5 years. It's a really good book if you like zombies.
Did you see the zombie movie?
I haven't seen it yet. That's the one I'm talking
about.
The
Brad Pitt thing.
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie, but the book is fantastic.
Okay. All right. Check that out.
So what's next, Ben Mezrich? And you mentioned, I think it was in a Globe interview I saw a couple of days ago recently, that you get pitches by the score practically every day through email, whatever. How far ahead do you plan?
Right.
And two, what's next? What are you working on?
I actually am going to probably have 3 books out in the next year.
Oh, this trilogy
you're
talking about.
That's one. Oh. Then I'm doing a children's... book, which is going to be a series about a group of geeky young kids in a private school in Newton, Mass, who use math and science to beat carnival games. And so it's kind of bringing out a house, brought to a younger level, comes out next summer.
Oh,
and then
God.
I have a big nonfiction story as well, but it's still under wraps. So,
Did you ever win one of those big, huge stuffed animals?
I did, and now it turns out, you know, you can use math and science to beat most of those games.
You can?
And you'll see when the book comes out next year.
No, is that really true?
Yeah, it is. Most of those games have tricks to them. It's going to be a fun little series. They're going to do different things each book. And
you should have told Barack Obama when he was at that thing on the
right.
Jersey Shore with Chris Christie.
Oh, I can beat all those games now. I've learned how. I can beat all of it.
Are you serious about this?
Science?
Yeah, I can beat them all.
Did you figure this out?
No, I mean, not alone, but there was, you know, I have my my network.
So when you take your little 3-year-old kid to the carnival,
he's not old enough yet,
but
when he's old enough,
you can wow
he's going to win all the stuffed animals.
That is unbelievable. Yeah.
Ben Mezrich is going to be corrupting minors from coast to coast. That's his basic message. We're talking to Ben Mezrich. Needless to say, I'm going to say the title of the book now, Straight Flush, the true story of 6 college friends who dealt their way to a $1 billion online poker empire and how it all came crashing down. Why do you decide? This is not the only book which has an extended title.
All of mine do.
Why do you do that?
You know, it started with Bringing Down the House.
Yeah, of course.
And after that one, every book I came out, the publishers did it. And then eventually, I think it was GQ made fun of all my titles and had them all lined up and then a bunch of fake titles. And it just became kind of my thing. So now every time I have a title, they add this huge subtitle to it.
You know, the 6 MIT students who took Vegas for Millions, they wound up doing pretty well.
Yeah, 21 was the movie. And that story just, you know, for me, changed my life and I think for them as well. So it was just one of those things. Yeah.
Now, here's a test for you, Ben Mezrich. We've done, before we leave here, we did the shorts thing. I want you to say the name of your book, every word included without looking at anything. Can you do it?
Straight Flush.
Go ahead.
The true story of 6.
I knew he couldn't do it.
Frat brothers.
No, I'm sorry. This is his own book and he doesn't even know the title. This is, go ahead.
Who built a poker empire.
Oh, my God.
Who built a $1 million poker empire. I don't know.
This is pathetic. Ben Mezrich. It's called Straight Flush, the true story of 6 college friends who dealt their way to a $1 billion online poker empire and how it all came crashing down.
He was close.
Ben, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for your time.
I guess I should read my title before I come on next
time. I think you should, or memorize it or something. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. We're not going away just yet. Stick around for a few more minutes to let you know how you can do your part to keep WGBH healthy.